Good morning. It's the 19th of June, 2018, Tuesday, here in the Lucy Coleman studio in Los Angeles, California, in the United States of America. I'm PJ, your internet pastor. I was going to bring this message that Cliff had edited, and I listened to a part of it, and it's superb, but unfortunately what's happening is that he's sending me some MP3s from back in Maryland, where he is, of my work, and it's not parsing correctly when I'm trying to put it up on the website. Technical difficulties that I have no idea what's going on, and so I'll try to take care of that later. And it's interesting because the piece was called The Value of Salvation, and then I had another one here that I was going to play by the late James B. Stanley, my Christian pastor mentor, and it has a title very similar to what I was going to put up, entitled, Are You Ready for the Last Day? And this was, I don't even have a year of this on here. And I don't recall this, and I was going to take you point by point, but I had to change everything. I want to talk with you a little bit today about something. I'm not an activist in any way. I don't want to be an activist. I don't want to be a spokesman for a bunch of people about politically what's going on, racially what's going on. I think that if you've come to my website for more than a week and you've listened to my work, you know who I am. A lot of people criticize me and say, well, John is a black man, but he's not really completely black because he doesn't sound like he has suffered enough under the black experience. Oh, I've suffered it. I've just learned how to wage warfare against things that particularly doesn't appeal to me. I try not to allow those things to affect me and to change my outlook on life. Politically, I still don't vote. I don't think that there's a need to do that. I was listening and watching an article when Barack Obama was speaking at the Cambridge Library. It's up on YouTube. I think the year was 1994 when he was giving an analysis of the book that I have in my library, Barack Obama, Dreams from My Father. I think I read halfway through it, but after watching the special on YouTube, I may go back to it. But Barack spoke extensively about his being a social worker in the Chicago community, in the African-American community. And when I look at Chicago today and think about the murders, the drive-bys and all of that, and Rahm Emanuel, the mayor I think he is, and what's going on in Chicago, and there's nothing going on to stop the inhumane treatment. As a matter of fact, yesterday I was having lunch in a restaurant with a friend of mine, and we had begun to discuss the problems of African Americans in this country. We were speaking as senior citizens, and right next to us in the booth was another black man in his 80s, 80, 81 or 82, I believe he told me. He gave me his name, and he pointed out that he was a member of Fred Price's church, Crenshaw Christian Center, and he began to ask a question. He says, how do you know you're saved, and are you sure, and all that kind of thing, and I was telling the guy, sir, because I mentioned the ministry that I was a part of, and he said, I've heard of that. And so, of course, I told him who I was. And he strictly word faith. He tried to come back with me with this thing, well, are you sure you're saved and all that kind of stuff. And I said, man, that's a bunch of mumbo jumbo to me. I said, my personal experience with God is mine, that I had in 1967 without the help of churches and religion and all of that. I try to tell people that, okay, if I'm not black enough for you, it's how I dealt with my blackness as a black man as I came up. I married because it was essential that a black man married, had a wife and had a family, and got him some kind of a slave or some kind of a job where he could make some money, take care of his family, and hopefully join some kind of an organization that and join you to the community. Barack Obama did when he joined that church in Chicago. You know, the preacher, I forget his name now. I used to be up on that, but I don't think about these people really. I don't think about Barack. He was the president, just like I don't think about Trump. Why? Everybody has a political mode that they're going to follow. Was Barack a good man? So to say, yeah, I guess. Back in 2008, I wasn't a fan of Barack Obama. Because, number one, I didn't know anything about him. Where did this cat come from? I mean, just out of the blue, he pops up on the political scene. And everybody's crying and carrying on. And so that kind of struck me as amusing. It amused me. It didn't amaze me. He was saying some of the things that I believed in, and I waited to see if his presidency would bring about something of that nature, and unfortunately it never did. Only a few people who benefited, that contributed to getting him elected, and played the political game altogether. I've never played it. But let's fast forward to right now. I was telling the two gentlemen at the restaurant yesterday that today I was going to go down to my local councilman's office and ask certain questions. How can a 74-year-old man help his community? I'm no longer employed as a professor of philosophy, an adjunct. I don't want to go back to work doing that. I want to get involved in my community. I don't want to make a name for myself. If I wanted to do that, I was reading in the paper where a church is looking for a pastor. Submit your resume. I don't need to do that. No one would hire me anyhow because my ideas are too biblical. But how do I contribute? And this I'm saying for the people that knew me when I was pastoring in a church. How do I contribute to the community that I live in? How do I help the community? Well, I help the community, I believe, by joining in with that community and seeking to understand them where they are, not where I think they ought to be. You know, we have this idea that when we talk to people, we have to tell them, well, you should be the way that I am. I think this way, and I think this is a good way to think, so you should think. Man, to hell with that. I don't need people thinking the way I think. I need people to get in touch. And I think Barack said a little bit of it when I was looking at the end of that clip on YouTube. He was saying, you have to look at deep down within yourself and see where you can contribute to the place where you are. And I believe that there's good people in Chicago, his hometown, his root city, that can do that. And I believe that I'm one of the good people in my city. Man, I recall when I worked for the LAPD years ago, and I was a chaplain, and we got together, and we were working in the community out of Wilshire PD, and had a lot of the cops working with me and meeting with people in the community, speaking with the youngsters and everything. That was a fun time. Well, here I am, 74. I still have the same frame of reference. Who's doing that now? Who is speaking for anybody anywhere now? It is so difficult to get people to become transparent with other people in order to help the people in the very community that you live in. And I was talking with a group of men at an old school dance party on Sunday afternoon, and I brought it up, and some of the men said to me, they said, people don't like to be transparent, John. People don't like to make themselves vulnerable to other people. I think that's where the conversation went, because in the restaurant, I was asking these two men, one man in his 60s and another man in his 80s, and of course, me in my mid-70s, and I'm asking the question, where are the elders? I said, we're three black men. I said, obviously, in the middle of a day, we're basically independent. We can go and have lunch, excuse me, wherever we wish, whenever we wish. We're independent. What are we doing? What are we doing to contribute to the infrastructure that seems to have crumbled? The 82-year-old guy tried to bring up some word faith doctrine, and I said, please, sir, don't talk to me about that. I used to go on the radio and argue against you guys because it didn't make any sense then. And I said, we're having a good conversation without you trying to move it into religion. It's like some black man came to my porch, a 90-year-old guy that was in the Jehovah Witness faith, and he was trying to share with me his faith, and I had to tell him, please don't do that. You don't know who I am. You don't know what I know. What I know about God, esoteric stuff, and I really don't fill up to it. I just tell people right up front, you don't know me. If you knew me and took the time to get to know me and to make yourself vulnerable and to allow me to make myself vulnerable with you, then you would know why this conversation on a religious scale ain't going nowhere, to put it plain. I was watching a little clip by Barack Obama, and he kind of smacked at Cornel West and say, well, Cornel West would say, well, you got to have faith. And he kind of chuckled about that, because Barack is not looking for help from some esoteric god way out in the atmosphere to help the conditions of race relations in this country. Well, I do. And I believe that the Spirit of God still works, yet works, but it doesn't work in the way that it did when I was a young man. I was telling this man in the restaurant yesterday, you cannot speak to the millennials and start telling them about some Jesus that went into a grave and 3 days later got up. And if you throw everything that you have in the life of this man, your life will become a cosmic killjoy and salvation has come. Salvation? How can salvation come when you ain't got a job? You can't feed your children. You've been forced out of the apartment with them because she can get more money if you weren't there. You've been marginalized because you as a black man now are not the shakers and movers that helped build this country. They're using the Latinas to do that now in our major cities. The black man is of no value at all. That's why I'm kind of apprehensive about going to my councilman or councilwoman and say, where can I be of help in my community? Okay, I get up every morning. I do what I do in my office. You know what? Straining to try to put old discourses up on my website, because I know that the truth of these discourses, when embedded into the life of an individual that is looking for a solution, that these things will help. But unfortunately, when they say, oh, he's a pastor, oh, he's a Christian, oh, he's one of those, oh, we don't need to hear that because he's going to want to take us to the tomb, get him out the tomb, and then resurrect us and have us sing one of them hip-hop church songs and do the holy dance and we're saved. Please, I'm not going there with you. I don't want to go there with you. That is not where I am. That's why when you come to my website, you see pictures of me playing the bongo drums with a young man that frequents my home very often. He's working at Uber, trying to make a living, and so he can make his money and go and take care of his life. I think that's a wonderful thing. But what about the other young man? I have an appointment tomorrow to help a young man, to counsel him, to talk with him, to get his mind right. I want to do that not on a single basis, but on a basis where I can reach a group of young black men. They've got to know that I have the background in Christianity, because that's where my moral ideas were forged. And it matters not about the preference of my friends and who my friends are, because that's a great part of who I am. You know, when people go to the social networks and see me, I want them to see me who I am. This is who I am. These are the people that I can speak with, that I can have, if you will, koinonia or fellowship with, because you got to be transparent with me. And if you can't be transparent with me about who you are, you aren't going to have a lively discussion with me, especially if you're going to jump into the Bible and bring up something that contextually doesn't even fit into the life that I'm in. That's why, you know, when I find these old tapes of my mentor, James B. Stanley, I find myself transliterating what he's talking about to you, because if you don't come from a background of Texas, outhouses, smokehouses, and shacks, and people that were fighting the worst kind of segregation in their lives, you won't understand my mentor. Now, when he tried to pass that on to me, I had to, and this is where the difficulty comes in, I had to relate what he was saying to the life that I was living, that I am living. Now, I had to take his sayings that he gave me back in the late 80s when I start recording this, well, 81, 82, and start recording this thing and keeping it as an archival evidence. When I play that for a millennial that comes to my site in 2018, I have to be able to bridge the gap and to define to them what's going on. I'm going to continue to do it, and I'll probably do this piece of Jake's stuff because I can't get mine from Cliff in Maryland, unfortunately, to come up. So I thought that I'd come in and tell you that these are the things that I'm wrestling with. I'm not spending that much time in the studio because I am attempting to get out there and look at myself and my community and give it the best shot that I possibly can before I leave the planet in death. You know, my daughter told me, she said, "Daddy, me and Delia are watching you very close, because when you can't drive anymore and maneuver, we're going to take your license and take your keys." They told me that. Those are daughters that love me. Right now, I still got a sound mind, and I can maneuver. I know what's going on. My mind is sharp. My dog is still barking at cats. And I agree with what she said. When I can't maneuver properly, then take my license, take my car, put me on Uber or Lyft. But I've got to be doing something practical. I'm not ready to go into the rest home yet. I'm not ready. A lot of people think of John Coleman as some old man. "Oh, man, you need to retire that voice of yours, John. You need to go in a rest home and get..." You're not going to go in a rest home and feed me applesauce and donuts and have me talking to old people laughing about the Four Tops. It's not laughable. Some of the greatest music that was ever recorded. But I'm not ready to hang it up. But I just wanted to share with you that I'm ready to expand, because black males, young black males, that have no fathers, that never had an elder speak with them the way that I'm... See, a lot of black males don't even know that I exist. If they have phones, they're the little county cheap phones. They don't have enough time on the internet to download one of my things and listen to me. I think that they need to listen to what I'm saying. And if they apply, listen to this, if they apply the spirituality that I'm talking about on a practical level, not through no church, not through no auspices of some denominational rigmarole and all that foolishness, but just like in the old days, God help me. I want to get married. I was talking with a 21-year-old guy, and he said, John, I want to get married, and I want to have children. He's gay. He says, I want to be with a woman and have children like you did. He said that was an enriching part of your life. And I said, can you last with love with the woman that you married? Did you hear what I put on my A Father's Day thing that I did on the 17th on Sunday? I played a record by Luther Vandross, Present a Rose to Your Woman. Call her up, tell her. I didn't do that to Lucy. I didn't know how to live with a woman properly. Why didn't I? Because my father was a playboy. He never taught me how to appropriately treat a woman. I married a woman because it was a thing to do back in the day. I believe I loved my woman with my whole heart, but I didn't know how to be with a woman. And even today, when they say, well, John, here's a nice woman, I'm not equipped for that. I'm not equipped to be with anyone right now. I don't want to be with anyone. What I want to do is to become a voice of one crying in the wilderness. My ancestors were brought over here as slaves, and I'm a part of that culture. I was brought up totally anglicized, trained to get a white education, to think like a white man, to do everything like that in order to be successful. I have seen in my life of 74 years many black men that refuse to get on that road. I recall one of my best friends recently passed away 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I would speak with him often throughout our times meeting. I says, come on, man, you got to pull it together. And he cursed me out one day. He says, John, I don't want to be like you. He said, you've chosen to follow this Eurocentric idea of paying taxes and getting with the program of life. He said, I'm going to use this system for everything that it has because it enslaved us. And he wanted me to become angry like himself. Now listen, I'm not living in a vacuum. I have a book right here in my study. Let me get up and grab it. It should be, yeah, here it is. Let me grab it and bring it back over to the mic. It's a great book. My daughter gave it to me on one of my birthdays, and it's called The Black Panther. No, not that movie. I'm going to go by some friends' homes. We're going to dress up in dashikis and everything and try and analyze the movie, because I saw the movie and I couldn't make up or down of it. But she bought me this book called The Black Panther, including the original Black Panther documentary on DVD, and I have that somewhere here around the house. When the Black Panther Party coming, and I want to tell you, this is a great book. It's just selected and edited by David Hilliard, if you know anything about Hilliard, and everything. It's a great book. And my daughter wanted me to read it because this was her way of getting me out of the mold that Anglicism had lambasted me in. I had a very successful career. I worked for the city. I became a very successful pastor of a church. I had one of the most outstanding apologetic radio ministries in the history of an African-American male. Didn't make very many friends because I never spoke with people to try to bump them up. Listen to this. I want to read this about Dr. Stan Oden. He starts off, power to the people, and then it lets you know where I'm going with this. It says, it was in the winter of 1972. At the time, I was working in my hometown, San Diego, as a community development specialist with the city of San Diego. Our work was part of the Model Cities program, a major foundation of President Lyndon Johnson's Great Society program. And so, you know, we've always had these programs. This is me talking now. We've always had these programs that we could turn to, and these programs were put forth. I think that they were piecemeal objectives, these kind of things to help us in the black community achieve it. Achieve this, because it was always difficult for us to accommodate ourselves. Now let me continue to read this. I was a member of the San Diego Convention Coalition, a group of anti-war, anti-imperialist, and feminist activists living in San Diego who were opposed to the Nixon regime plan to hold the National Republican Convention in our town in late August of that summer. So this person was involved in the political processes. In 1972, I was married, and Lucy and I were getting ready to buy our first home. I was working for the city of Los Angeles as a warehouseman, LAPD, on Fletcher Drive in Hillcrest. It was Fletcher Drive, and I forget the name of that street. But it was right across the street from the Van Camp Bakery, LAPD Supply Division. It's no longer there. That's what I was doing. I remember this. I was a young man. Then he says, I joined the coalition. I'm going back to Stan Oden's thing. He joined the coalition because of the need to get black people radical progressive voice into the resistance struggle against the Republican convention, and was joined by several other black radical activists. San Diego in 1972 was bereft of much black radical activism following the repression of the Black Panther Party by the police and the FBI, along with the deaths of John Savage, who I grew up with, and Sylvester Bell, at the hands of Ron Karenga's U.S. organization. And that's interesting because Ron Karenga became a professor of African-American studies at Cal State Long Beach here in the Southern California area, and is yet involved with some kind of political strain, albeit not the Black Panther Party, but he did have that background. Then this person goes on and says that he negotiated between key U.S. organization members who he was associated with doing his work in the Model Cities program and the revolutionary nationalist expressions and political still existing in Southwest San Diego. So here's a man that was involved in the fight. While he was involved in the fight, what was I involved in? Wait a minute. Got my wires here in the studio getting all tangled up. I was involved in being married and raising two children and paying taxes and all that. A black man in Los Angeles, I guess I lucked out in a sense and got me a darn good job. So Craig L. Rice wrote an article in this book. Let me share some of that. In his section, it says, One day in the late 1960s, without fanfare, several brothers dressed in the outfits that would become eternal symbols of their rebellion dropped the newspaper on the street corners of the Twin Cities and opened up the revolution to the Midwest and the revolutionary in me. Revolution, revolutionary, these words, which had little life, little meaning to me at the time, roused the sense of wrong, the thirst for justice I'd already felt burning in my soul. Well, now since I'm no longer pastoring, and nobody seems to want the righteous mode of living, the revolutionary seems to be bursting in me. When I think of young black men shooting other young black men in the city that my sister lives in Chicago, hey man, that hurts. That hurts. Here I am at 74, and I know what Malcolm felt. No, I didn't follow Martin Luther King that much because he marched and let somebody hit him upside the head and threw him in jail, and I understand what that was about. When you're coming against a white power structure, you got to do what you got to do. But I mean, something has to be done better than a bunch of chit-chat that our so-called black leaders, if you can call them that, have been doing, sitting around chit-chatting, talking about nothing. And so I'm reading that. And all of this in these books, they have all these people here, you know, writing about it. Panther politics caused major breakthrough in prison censorship. And this is by Kumasi. Kumasi writes and says, by 1970, the FBI's war against the Black Panthers was in full swing. Now, if it was in full swing, I didn't know anything about it. This is me, John Coleman, talking. I didn't know anything about it. I was too busy trying to sustain my city job, raise my wife that I had married, learn how to get along with a woman, and have a life. Listen to this. He goes on and says, there have been numerous assaults, murders, and arrests of party members and leaders around the country. The only chapter was getting itself established in San Quentin, and it was too under siege. Things were moving so fast in the outside world that those of us in prison had to read every newspaper and magazine that we can get a hold on in an attempt to keep up with societal events and experiences beyond our reach. Now, that is beyond imagination to me at that time. And this was before, listen to me, people, before I started to go to college to obtain my, let's see, this is 1970? That's right. That was before I started to go to college to obtain my first degree. Before I started going to East LA Junior College, I was politically unplugged. A black man growing up in the city. A lot of people wrote these beautiful, beautiful articles here. And in this book that my daughter gave me, she gave it to me as my, and I'm burgeoning now as an older black man because I wasn't interested in messing up my job and my career following this. Huey Newton, this young man was brilliant. He really was. Quotations from Huey Newton in this book here. Let me see if I could read it. It's kind of small print. It says, the only political power that I can see that we can build would be politically destructive. It is not one choice to be destructive. I can't read it. It's too small. The print is too small. So I'm going to have to get on a pair of thicker glasses. But haven't read that. I haven't read the whole book. I'm just here's an interesting point I'd like to share with you. The last statement by John Huggins, who is Deputy Minister of Information of Southern California. And this says, Los Angeles, the Panthers intensify. And let me see what year this was. Well, I'll just read it. It says, the Black Panther Party, Southern California chapter, in compliance with the director of the Central Committee of the Black Panther, has moved to purge this chapter's ranks of provocative agents, kook, and the and various fools, avarice fools, he calls them. I guess that they were trying to purge the party of the Uncle Toms that got in there, because what happened is that the FBI infiltrated the Black Panthers and tried to bring it down from within the party itself. And I found this interesting. Whenever the black man got together to build anything, to feed his children, to clean up his community, to do that, white men always seemed to, you know, become frightened of that. Oh man, you can't. And do you know why? Because if you do world history, whenever the black man got together and built something and then coincided it with friends to become strong, that's what I was talking about in that meeting with those men yesterday. I said, we need to allow ourselves to become vulnerable around other men. Let's become vulnerable around those men so that we can know these men, so that we can work together. And then I was saying, brothers, we have to help these young men that are growing up, because our young men seem to have absolutely no direction at all. All they want to do is party, party, party. And I'm looking at a bunch of older men that have careers, collegiate degrees, and everything else. I was speaking with a friend of mine. He called me yesterday. No. We were on the social network, and he began to speak with me. And I said to him, I said, man, you sound like a man that is totally depressed. You are suffering with depression. Then he called me on the phone, and I told him, the way that you fight depression is get busy. I said, we are the adults, we are the elders in our community. What are we doing? It makes no difference whether you're gay, straight, or anything. If you're a black elder in our community, in the inner cities, we have to look out now to protect what we have left of these young minds. Black people are not having babies. And then when you look at the abortion rate, and then look at the food that we're eating in our communities, they're killing us. And some of the water systems and major population growths are all screwed up. We are jacked up, and we're around here fighting each other. It's ridiculous. So I am kind of like in agreement. Now, in the book, it shows the Chairman Mao of the People's Republic of China and how the Black Panther Party had adopted some of his revolutionary views. And I know that a lot of people didn't like that. That's why I couldn't follow the party back in the day, because I was drafted into the U.S. Army. And I went into the U.S. Army, and one of the first things that they did when they had us in there is that they taught us how to come against communists. The communists were the enemies. I couldn't bring myself to follow the Black Panther Party because of my upbringing. I guess like a lot of black friends said to me, John, you're a little bit too white. It isn't that I was too white. I couldn't see. Come on, man. And the way they start shooting us up and killing us, oh my goodness. But they had this thing outlined. I want to read some of the rules of the Black Panther Party. I'm going to share this, and I'm sharing this with you because I'm feeling this now. I am feeling this. I want to be the revolutionary now. Why, as an older man? There's nothing else left for us but freedom. Total freedom, man. Total freedom to be who we are, where we are. To hell with anyone else trying to take that freedom from us. I think that since God birthed us, the greatest thing that He birthed us with is a sense of personal freedom. And it may start middle life, young life, whenever it starts, this sense of personal freedom. And God gives us the ability to live this out. That's why my background in Christianity is important. I was telling the brothers at this thing yesterday. I am a retired pastor. I said, I know that Bible. I can exegete it. I've done it. You can figure that out just by hanging around my website a couple of weeks. I know that. But you know what? We need to cut some of this bull crap out that's happening to us as black people. And we need to pull together to love our people. Not say, oh man, that nigga never be nothing. I love everybody I come in contact with. You mean, what's he doing with him? What in the hell you think I'm doing with him? I'm being transparent. I wouldn't hang around those kind of people. I know you've been anglicized to the degree that you don't even want to hang around your own people and get into knowing what they know. Now, I'm going to try to read this, and I'm trying to, I think I better get some, let me get some stronger glasses here, because I want to read this before this webcast goes out. And I've been talking 42 minutes, and I only had the intention of talking 10. I didn't know. Wait a minute, let me stand up and go over here. You should see what I did with these wires in the studio. I got my chair all messed up. No wonder I'm having technical difficulties. I'm just rolling over this, rolling over that. Now, let's keep that over there. Now, let me go over here and get these glasses, hopefully, so that I can see this small print in this magazine much clearer. Thank you guys for putting up with me. You know, PJ's getting old now. The old man's getting old. What do you mean he's becoming a revolutionary? I'm saying, hey, I'm rebelling against anything that holds back my freedom. You hear me? Hell. Every member of the Black Panther Party throughout this country of racist America, this is from the central headquarters in Oakland, California, racist America, must abide by these rules as functional members of the party. Central committee members, central staffers, local staffers, including all captains subordinate either to the national, state, or local leadership of the Black Panther Party will enforce these rules. Length of suspension or other discriminatory actions necessary for violation of these rules will depend upon national decisions of national, state, areas, and local committees and staffers where said rules or rules of the Black Panther Party were violated. Every member of the party, this is in the Constitution that I'm reading to you right now. Every member of the party must know these verbatim by heart. and apply them daily. You know, this sounds like me teaching a Bible study at the church, or having a conference, taking the men up the hill up there and trying to get... Every time I try to put together things like this for men to live up to this on the biblical sense, it failed. All right. Then it says, each member must report any violation of these rules to their leadership or to their counter-revolutionary, and are subjected to suspension by the Black Panther Party. Now, they got these rules in it, and they got 26 of them. And I think I got enough time. I want to give these to you. Number one, no party member can have narcotics or weed in his possession while during party work. Now, that's good. Because he's saying, now, he didn't say that you can't smoke no weed, but he said you can't have it in your possession, because at that time it was illegal. And if you given the police the right to come in, especially in California when it was illegal to have marijuana, but then you can shut us down. So you can't have that mess on your possession when you come in here. I love it. See, that's protecting the party. That makes sense. Number two, any party member found shooting narcotics will be compelled from this party. Expelled from this party. Yeah. In other words, if you're shooting, what do you shoot? Heroin and all that stuff? They said, we're not going to have you in if you're an addict. They wanted clear minds. Clear minds. Number three, no party member can be drunk while doing daily party work. I tried to be sober. See, they knew brothers. They knew the hood. And it's good rules thus far. Rule number four, no party member will violate the rules resulting to relating to office work, general meetings of the Black Panther Party, and meetings of the Black Panther Party anywhere. In other words, you're going to follow the rules, or you're not going to be a part of this party. It's just as simple as that. I like that. That's the way I was as a pastor. All right. Now, let's go to the next one. No party member will use, point, or fire a weapon of any kind unnecessarily or accidentally at anyone. I like that. Number six, no party member can join any other army force other than the Black Liberation Army. So you see, now that would have just lined me out, because I had Army Reserve meetings that I had to go to after I got out of the Army. Here's number seven. No party member can have a weapon in his possession while drunk or loaded off of narcotics or weed. Number eight. No party member will commit any crime against other party members or Black people at all, and cannot steal or take from the people, not even a needle or a piece of bread. I love it. And these things may seem rudimentary to you and say, oh man, this is childish. You have to understand the state of mind that the Black community was in. These are soldiers. That's why when this movie comes out, the Black Panther Party, what are they trying to do? Look at this, number nine. When arrested, Black Panther members will give only name, address, and will sign nothing. Legal first aid must be understood by all party members. Okay, I got that. In other words, don't be talking. And I like that. Keep your mouth shut. At least until you get some representation. Number 10. The 10-point programs and platforms of the Black Panther Party must be known and understood by each party member. I would hope so. Number 11. Party communications must be national and local. Number 12. The 10-10-10 program should be known by all members and also understood by all members. Number 13. All finance officers will operate under the jurisdiction of the Ministry of Finance. I like that they have this stuff together. Number 14. Each person will submit a report of daily work. I like that. That's keeping everything on the up and up. Number 15. Each subsection, leader section, leader lieutenant, and captain must submit daily reports to work. You know, I like the discipline of this. Only once, there was a member of my church, I think it was my associate pastor, he came up to me and he asked me, he says, John, have you ever looked at the Black Panther Party? I said, man, I don't have time to look at that. I'm looking strictly at the Bible. That's right. I was challenged. But I never took the challenge beyond the challenge to me was nothing but a threat. A threat to where I was exegetically and what I was trying to do in biblical Christianity. At 74 years old and having researched all these giant Christian groups around here with all these millions of dollars and finding out that some of these Christian groups are supporting the Trump agenda, which is, can I be real, bullshit. I can no longer with a clear mind support these groups or support anything that these people stand for. But these people have revealed themselves to be blatant racist and needs their booty kicked, to tell you the truth. I'm sorry that may sound a little gruff to some of you that don't have no other outlet but sheer racism to defend your point of view. No, you're just building up the revolutionary in me, because I'm not going to stand for it. I'm not going to stand for it. And that's one thing that I like about the millennials. They're not going to stand for it. They're not. And these millennials, a lot of them, are ready to die. And you know what? Dying ain't that bad. It really isn't. It really isn't. Now, what number was I on? Okay. Number 14, each person will submit a report, daily work. Number 15, each section, leader, lieutenant, and captain must submit daily reports of their work. Number 16, all Panthers must learn to operate and service weapons correctly. That's good. Information to the editor of the newspaper so that it will be published in the paper and will be known by all chapters and branches. They had that thing hooked up and connected. That's why J. Edgar Hoover and his FBI agents went around shooting and killing and tearing up these things and everything, and under the auspices that they were trying to protect America from becoming red Chinese communists. Oh, I remember all that stuff. That's why I strayed away from this Black Panther Party. Because the FBI would come in and tear up your stuff and have you looking stupid. And man, I saw the pictures when they went in and shot up these people in the bed, when they in bed with their sweethearts and just come in there and kill them. Oh, it was terrible back in the day. Number 18, political education classes are mandatory for general membership. That's right, you had to educate these people because they had been anglicized. And now since everybody's free in America, I'm free too. I just want to let you people know who I am. Don't get it twisted. I still have a tremendous regard for the God that created the heavens and the earth. a tremendous regard for those biblical principles that have sustained me, my family, and my way of life. But I also have a great love and regard for the people that I look more like. Oh, yeah. Number 19. Only office personnel assigned to respective offices each day should be there. All others are to sell papers and to do political work in the community, including captains and section leaders and etc. In other words, get on out there and make money for the party. That's what it's all about. That's called networking. I like that. Communications, number 20. It says all chapters must submit weekly reports in writing to the national headquarters. Number 21, all branches must implement first aid and medical cadres. Number 22, all chapters, branches, and components of the Black Panther Party must submit a monthly financial report to the Ministry of Finance and also to the Central Committee. See, they got to know how much money they had. They were building a party. The party is fragmented today, but thus far, I like what they're putting together. Number 23. Oh, and by the way, this is the first time I ever read all these documents. My daughter gave me the book a number of years ago. I have been dealing with open heart surgery and everything else and taking a close look at everything. I know this sounds radical to a lot of you that are very strong Christians, but you better look at them choking, beating out, shooting, killing black men in the street like dogs. Oh no, watch this. Number 23. Everyone in a leadership position must read no less than 2 hours per day and keep abreast to the changing political situation. Boy, you talking about keeping your mind sharp. I like that. Number 24, no chapter or branch shall assent grants. Any other kind of, I think that's perversity funds and money, or any other form of government agency without contacting the national headquarters. Right. That makes sense. Don't be taking that money because all it does is keeps you on the slave plantation. I got it. Number 25, all chapters must adhere to the policy and the ideology laid down in the Central Committee by the Black Panther Party. And lastly, number 26, all branches must submit weekly reports in writing to their prospective chapters. Those are the rules for the Black Panther Party. And that came out in May 4, 1969. And my first daughter wasn't even born yet. And I didn't even know that this was an existing thing. And if I had known and had become revolutionary, I probably would have been very much acquiescent into that because of my revolutionary nature as an apologist. Now, I think my hour's about up. And you may say, you could have played a sermon or something. No, hold on. I am politically tied in to what's going on in the world that I live in. I am emotionally, my ideology and everything has remained biblical, but with a sense of an urging for freedom. All right. Love to hear from some of you, especially you diehard Christians, on what you think about this webcast today. Tell your friends, all right? Hey, may Jehovah keep you. Stay into His Word.